Blog Talk Radio.
Out there. I just looked out the window to make sure. And we're back to Michigan again. Yeah, back there. We're going first to Detroit, to the home of a place called the Whitney, which is a former mansion turned restaurant. And hopefully manager Tony Musi, I think he pronounces his name, will talk about the mansion and as well as what was on the menu. And then continuing with the subject of art that we talked about this week, we go to East Lansing to visit the Saper Galleries. And Roy Saper will not only give us a tour, but he relate a story about acquiring a Hebron glass collection. And then we're also going to go to have a little chat about the city of Ann Arbor and what's to do there. But before we do anything, I guess, the sponsors, they got to have their say here. Yes, okay.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies. And that's no fairy tale.
Oh, yes. And you can get these wonderful brownies at www.brownies.com. Interesting. I'm going to be getting some, they're not the brownies. They came up with some new ones lately, lemon bars, and I guess like a cinnamon crumb cake type thing. So I will certainly let you know how they are. So what I'm gonna do? Let's see. Here we are. Do I have this thing where I can call? Let's see. All right. Let me see if I can call. They probably got a little busy. I can give out the number. 313-832-5700. And let's see if I can... If I can get Tony. Okay. It's ringing for me in my game. Okay. One, two ringy dingies. Three ringy dingies. thingies. Aha. I bet you're going to say they're not open. And no one's answering. Okay, I guess we're not going to do that then. Well, that's it.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling the week.
Okay, somebody got it. Let's try it again. Let's do this again. Okay. Okay, 832, 5700. Okay, there we go. No, I wasn't uploading the audio. Boy, and he just starting here. All right, dial. There we go. Let's try again. Let's try again.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling the Whitney. How may we help you?
Yes, is Tony available?
He's not available now, but I can put him on your voicemail if you want.
Well, he's supposed to be on my calling on my radio show right now.
Well, maybe he's doing that. He's just not here right now.
Ah, okay. Well, no, that's not happening. That's why I'm calling to call him. Okay.
Let me just check and see if I can run him down, okay?
Okie dokies.
Should I put you on hold or what?
Oh, yeah, well, you can. You could do that. That's fine.
All right, ma'am. I won't be long.
Okie dokie. All right, let's see. In the meantime, why don't
We appreciate your patience. Please hold the line, and we'll be right back.
Don't you just love when these things happen? This is reality, folks. Okay. Where's my...
Please continue to hold. We'll be back with you as soon as possible.
Where's my birds? My chickens. Where are you guys? Where are you guys? Come on. Come on in. Yes.
Thank you for holding. We look forward.
Come on. Come on.
Moment.
Okay. And what about the other one? Okay. Well, do you,
your call is very important to us.
That was Marilyn and Minerva,
just a moment,
who went with me to Michigan. Well, not really. They weren't supposed to say that they went with me to Michigan because they have their own blog, so it doesn't look
Tony
like
speaking.
It. Tony?
Yes.
You know, you're supposed to be calling me now.
Oh, I didn't know I was supposed to call you. Sorry. Let me write down your number and I'll call you.
Well, it doesn't matter now because you're on the air.
Ah, fantastic. How are you today?
Okay. So, what we first wanted to, let's take a tour. Give me a little history of the mansion and then we'll take a tour of it. And then we'll talk about the food.
All right. Well, the mansion was completed in 1894. It was built by Mr. Whitney, who did make his fortune as a lumber baron. Started out in Massachusetts and then moved out to the Midwest. Expanded all the way into Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and the surrounding areas. After being extremely successful in the lumber industry, he became one of the biggest investment bankers and real estate speculators in the city of Detroit. Upon the time of his death in 1900, he did die the wealthiest man in Detroit with a net worth of $15.5 million. The house that he built, that the restaurant now resides in, was completed in 1894. It did cost $400,000 to build and another $400,000 to furnish. Is shelled in pink jasper granite from South Dakota, has American oak, mahogany, and tiger's eye wood from Africa all throughout. It is gorgeous.
Yes, That is true. How, now, there's a lot of rooms there, aren't there?
There are. There's more than I've ever planned on counting. But they are, the house has been kind of chopped up a little bit from its original layout, if you will, from when it was converted into a restaurant in the early 80s. But the front half of the house does still remain in its original form. The third floor is now a bar. It was originally an art gallery. The second floor, which was their main living quarters, we now use for private event space. And for those who have not been, the first floor is hands down the most beautiful dining space in the city of Detroit, if not the state of Michigan.
Wow. So if you're on, if I said I'd like to take a tour, how many rooms do I actually get to see?
I'd say roughly around 15. 15 to 20 rooms, depending upon the size of the tour.
Oh, okay, because I understand it was like over 50 rooms.
No, there's over 50 rooms in the entire mansion. That would mean I'd have to take you into kitchens. I'd have to take you into walk-in coolers. I'd have to, you know, take you to the service bar. There was over 50 rooms when the house was originally built. Now the tours consist of the front half of the mansion, which there's roughly four rooms on the third floor I'd take you to. There's roughly 5 to 6 rooms on the second floor I'd take you to. And then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 rooms on the first floor I'd take you to.
Oh, okay. So that's a nice walk.
It is. It usually takes about 25 minutes. 25 minutes to a half hour. We do offer champagne tours Monday through Friday at 1:30 and 3 p.m. And it does come with a glass of champagne. And those are much more in-depth, and those usually take about 45 minutes. The tours that we give to regular diners during normal dining hours are still very extensive, but they are shortened due to the fact that there's a lot going on in the restaurant during those times.
So there's a charge for a tour?
If you come in for dinner, you do not get charged for a tour. However, if you did want to just come in for a tour, they are $10 a person, but that does come with a glass of champagne. Or any non-alcoholic beverage, if you so chose.
Oh, okay. That's not so bad.
I know it is definitely worth it. The house is beautiful.
Yes.
The thing that we get a lot of people to do that want to come in during the day, we get a lot of ladies that like to come in for high tea, which is something we offer with a 24-hour advance reservation. It's served Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. It is a four-course meal. It comes with a scone course, a soup and salad course, a sandwich course, and a dessert course, and of course is accompanied with decaffeinated or caffeinated tea, depending upon your preference. And that is always accompanied with a tour of the facility. It's a really nice, you know, it's kind of gossip hour, if you will. A lot of ladies, young and old, like to come out and have some tea, chat with their friends, and then get a private tour of the house.
And is this a fixed price for the
tea? Yes, this is $29 a person.
Okay, so it's, if you can kind of say it's like, in terms of the quantity of food type of thing, it's like having lunch kind of thing.
Yeah, it's considered a light late afternoon lunch.
Okay, so now in terms of the if you want to call the public rooms, not because you also I'm guessing that there are dining spaces. That are used like for parties kind of thing.
Sure.
As well. So if you're coming in for dinner, how many different
rooms can you dine in?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we do offer our full dinner menu on the third floor in the Ghost Bar, which if you're like me, I'm being a restaurant guy, I always prefer to sit at a bar, but, you know, not everybody's me. But you can get the full dinner menu at the bar. You can also get it at any of the number of tables that are in the bar. And that does consist of 3 smaller rooms and 1 big room. So there's 4 rooms there. And on the first floor, what did I count? There were 6 rooms on the first floor, all of which you can dine in. The way that the house is laid out, depending upon the volume of business we have that day, we just close certain rooms off. We don't seat the whole first floor. We'll seat, our two most popular rooms to seat are the drawing room and the library. Those are ones that are always set, and the dining room are really the three most popular ones. Those rooms are set every night without fail. The rest of the rooms get opened up for like a Friday or a Saturday or any day that we have high volumes of business. But you're more than welcome to look at those rooms on the days that you come to dine. We just don't seat them.
Now, where I dined, that was the library?
Was the dining room.
Oh, that was the dining room.
That was the formal dining room. There's actually two dining rooms. There's the formal dining room on the first floor and private dining room on the second floor.
I was trying to figure it out. I was, like, looking at the photos and stuff. I said, ooh, that looks like the library because there was a particular thing there that I saw in the photo. Well, okay, so I guess the article has a lie in it.
That's all right.
Okay.
Leave some mystery to it.
This is true. So, but there was this whole story about the things that are up there in that room that we dined at.
Yes, the story of the babies. That is something, that is a trick on my sleeve that I would not like to give on the open air. You got to come in to see that for yourself. It is very wonderful. It's a very cool story. Everybody gets a huge kick out of it. But, that is definitely one of my aces up my sleeve, that one there. So you're
so
just going to have to...
In other words, it's kind of thing of there's things on the walls that you have to look carefully at.
You have to look very carefully at, and you have to have a trained eye to point them out, if you will, unless you're extremely, extremely observant.
Okay. So let's go into now, in terms of the menu, what would you say is the cuisine?
The cuisine is classic American cuisine. It is, it's beef Wellington is our signature dish. Carrot cake is our signature dessert. We have the tomahawk steak, which is a 24-ounce bone-in ribeye. It's big steaks, lobster tails, classic salmon dishes, lamb chops. It's very elegant, very straightforward, classic American cuisine.
Okay, as a matter of fact, that would be a great idea. I'm going to pull up the article. In the article, I have everything I ate. I didn't leave anything out. Okay, so let's pull
it
up.
Sure. If I remember, you folks ate very well.
Yes, we certainly did. Okay, here's my... there we are. We're at the Whitney. Okay. All right. We started off. Now, it was... The chef that evening was Greg Pawlowski?
Yes, that is correct. That is our chef de cuisine.
Okay. And the appetizers. We had hamachi and tuna tartar.
Yeah.
Yeah, go describe it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the tuna and hamachi tartar is a classic raw fish dish. The tartar itself is tossed in poppy seeds with some olive oil, and it's wrapped in a cucumber skin. And the hamachi is classic sashimi style, thinly sliced fish.
Okay. I have. I'm not doing well here. My description, according to the menu, had said. Uzi marmalade.
Oh yeah, the uzu ponzu and the marmalade. Those are different sauces that are painted on the plate. I was talking about the actual tartar.
Ah.
But yes, the plate is accompanied with those. Those are different sauces that are painted on the plate for your dipping pleasure, if you will. But the actual tartar and hamachi is what I was describing.
Oh, which I didn't get. I guess I shouldn't have. But I can always change my blog, which is great. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll re-listen to what you said and then add the description of the hamachi and tuna tartare. Okay, the next thing I had on there was Chesapeake Bay Lump Crab Brick Roll.
Yes, the crab brick roll is a thin dough, take on a crab cake that that is rolled and it is pan fried. It is, you know, it is stuffed very well with not a lot of filler, a lot of crab meat, and it does come with some pickled onions, and does also come with a mustard sauce that we paint on the plate.
Okay, yeah, which I'm going to be hungry by the time, of course.
I'm hungry. I'm hungry every day I work here. It's a price you pay for working at such a place.
I know.
Walking around smelling this food all day.
Yeah. Then we had the calamari.
Okay. Now, how long ago were you here? Because we recently just changed the calamari. I'm trying to wonder. We changed it from rings to calamari steak. I don't know if you remember which one you had. The setup is still the same. It's still with the vegetables, the capers, and the beurre blanc. But the actual cut of the calamari is something we did recently change.
When you say the steak, in other words, as opposed to, and I know what you're talking about, usually what you wind up getting, you either get, sometimes you get rings and...
You get...
If you want to
yeah.
but what you're doing is you're cutting it up so...
So they're in thin, they're in long, thick strips.
Okay.
It adds a little bit more texture. They hold flavor better. It's not what you classically think of when you think of calamari, which is why most restaurants serve the rings of the tentacles. We just decided to make the switch just because they're much more flavorful. They cook easier, and they're just a better product all the way around.
Oh, okay. The next thing was the eggplant bruschetta.
The eggplant bruschetta is another one of our classic dishes. This is a breaded eggplant that is pan-fried and it is pan-fried with mozzarella cheese, and it is put over. I apologize, Parmesan cheese, and it is put over a French crostini, which is a thinly sliced toasted piece of bread.
Okay, and it says an house pickled vegetables.
Yes, and it does also come with pickled vegetables.
Okay. I believe I had a shrimp bisque.
Yes, our sherry cream shrimp bisque is our house soup. It is our house soup that is a cream-braised shrimp bisque, and it does come also with a crostini and a poached shrimp that we garnish it by floating the crostini on top and placing the poached shrimp on top of that.
Cool. That was good. Not that anything was bad. Okay. And then we had I had the beef Wellington, that's the classic.
Yes, the classic beef Wellington is a piece of tenderloin cut, prime filet. It is wrapped with a mushroom duxelle, which is a thinly sliced mushroom, and also with prosciutto and spinach. It is then wrapped in a puff pastry and cooked at temperature, so you could order it. You know, we don't suggest anything over mid-well with the Wellington because then the puff pastry starts to flake away. But we, you know, we recommend it anywhere from mid-rare to medium.
Now, one of the things that you were offering was I guess people didn't catch what, filet mignon on the bone.
Oh, our bone and filet, yes. This is this is a special that we run here quite often. It is what our chef considers, and I'll agree because I've had it, it is the best cut of steak that he has ever tried. It comes from the Fairway Packing Group, which is a local meat distributor that ages their meat right here in Eastern Market. What they do is they hang the steaks in a cooler that has a giant, also our tomahawk ribeye is aged here as well, and they suspend the meat in this cooler that has a giant brick of Himalayan rock salt in the middle of the room. And from time to time, they send winds through the room of up to 200 miles per hour. So what it does is it collects salt off of the rock salt and proceeds to, for lack of a better term, pound it into the meat until the salt tenderizes, melts into the fat, and is just phenomenal. That is one of our classic dishes here, is the bone-in. It is actually not on our menu, but it is something that we feature quite often. And it usually comes over haricot vert, which is a French baby green bean, and seasonal mushrooms. Right now we're doing chanterelle mushrooms. Throughout the summer we did morel mushrooms. Mushrooms are very seasonal, so we change the mushrooms that we put on top of it depending upon what season it is.
Now, when you, because people make an assumption of you're getting filet, there is no bone. So the filet mignon is part of, is it part of a T-bone? Is that what it is?
No, the actual bone you are getting, and I'm not 100% on this, I'm fairly positive on this, but the bone that you are actually getting is a vertebrae. Because the tenderloin runs along the straps of the back on both sides. So I'm fairly convinced the piece of bone you're getting is a vertebrae.
Okay. So in other words, if you're going, when you're going shopping and you want to get, you can't get filet mignon with a bone.
No, I would say that it would be very hard to find unless you went to a butcher and caught him before he actually butchered up the meat, because the first thing he's going to do is take it off the bone.
Okay. I'm gonna try that. I have a butcher that I was that I had gone to, and that would be.
Well, the whole reason you keep it on the bone is that it keeps the nutrients alive in the meat much longer, so that the meat is much fresher.
Okay, I've always gotten filet mignon. I mean, not necessary from the butcher. It's always like cryovac'd or in a whole big chunk kind of thing, and you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like, I don't know that when I'm getting it, like that whoever the, well, not the butcher, in other words, like at the store, wherever I'm getting it, they're not actually cutting it from the bone.
Well, the thing is the amount of work that it takes in order to, the amount of work that it takes in order to butcher a tenderloin that way is much more intensive than it is to just keep the whole tenderloin intact and to debone it.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly going to go try, see if I can get that. Then we also, well, I guess we didn't get a chance. There's gardens out there, right?
There are gardens. We do have a deck area. We do also have a fountain area that has a really beautiful fountain. It is very lush with greenery, lilac bushes, and the like.
Oh, cool. Is there an opportunity to dine in the garden? Anyway?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Is there an opportunity to dine in the garden?
Yes, there is if the weather is right.
Oh, okay. So when you say as far as to have dinner as opposed
yes,
to
yes, of course,
you know,
you can you
like that. So you can
mm-hmm.
have dinner.
I think we're past the time of year in which that would work right about now.
Yeah.
It's just a little too chilly out, but I mean all summer long if you wanted to have a full course meal outside, that was more than possible.
Oh. Okay, that's pretty good. Great atmosphere, and I guess
yes.
A lot. Do you tend to like do wedding parties like to do?
We do a lot of events of everything from weddings to well, mostly the weddings is what we do outside, but we do all kinds of events in the building. The building is designed very well for events because the rooms are separated so that we can still keep our regular diners in one part of the house while we have a party in another part of the house.
Okay, that's great. So, I guess the Whitney's open all year round, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so, and the website?
Yep. Is thewhitney.com.
Oh, easy enough to...
To remember.
To remember, yeah. Okay, and I'm assuming that it's suggested to call for reservations.
Yes,
right?
Reservations are highly encouraged.
Okay, I would imagine so. Well, if you're not, even if you're just stopping by for a quick lunch or something like that, I mean, it's worth the view of this place. It's just
exactly.
And I have to say, from the outside, you have to read the sign that says that it's a restaurant.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
When you're
outside,
when you're outside of the Whitney, you have to make sure you read a sign that actually lets you know that it's a restaurant, because from standing out in the street, it looks
right, like it's very hard to tell. It is very hard to tell.
You know, going, oh, there's this mansion here. I wonder what it is. Oh, here it is. It's a sign. It says that it's a restaurant.
We are lucky that we're such a tradition in the city of Detroit. The Whitney Restaurant is a tradition that dates back, you know, all the way back to the early 80s, that most people are aware that we're here.
That's
not an obstacle we have to get over too often.
Okay. That's good to know. Okay. Well, I thank you very much for sharing the information with us. I will certainly, because I think by the time I'm done with this radio show, I'm going to be raiding my refrigerator anyway. now I'll let you go back to work.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, Taylor.
Tell the chickens I said hi.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. It's always great to talk about food, isn't it? I love to talk about food. And I will eat soon. Now, let me just look at the tuts there. Okay, so I'm now waiting for Roy Safer to call in. You know, I forgot on my, I got so busy that I totally forgot that I also have a tile place, Matawi tile place calling in as well, which is in Ann Arbor. And but let's see, I wonder, like, where was looking on my, going to have an interview with Norwal, N-A-W-A-L, Matawi, from the Matawi Tile Place, who'll be calling in at 3 p.m. It's now 2:30. Look at this. And I, nothing. Mail delivery notification failure. Where was my problem now? Okay. They didn't want to go there. Okay. So, let's see. Since I'm not getting that phone call, let's try. Okay. Let me pull this up. I think I got the Matawi. Where was that again? And I'll just call that person. And okay, not my day, huh? For getting people are forgetting, I guess, you know. Let's do this. Okay. Let me do this there. Cut and paste kind of thing. Edit, copy. Much easier. And, nope, that's Matawi. Nope, sorry. Back to the inbox. I should play some music. Let's play some music while I get this. I should probably have called in. Well, yeah, my chicken is it, giving me looks. I should have called everybody this morning or whatever to remind them. I know. I just, you know, what could you do? What do I have here? Okay. I just like it. Just, I'm going to play this song just because I like it. What's his face? Josh Groban. I'm playing You Raise Me Up. Maybe by this time I'll stop it when I get somebody on the phone.
You know what? This is the gallery where that Roy owns, but he's on the other line waiting for you. He wanted to call and let me call and let you know that he is on the other line.
What other line?
There's a Google Voice that he's calling through from home.
Okay, and is he calling in the phone number I gave him?
Yes, and he said he's been on hold for a little while.
'Cause that's not coming up.
It's not coming up. Okay.
No. The number you're calling me is coming up from the gallery.
Okay. Well, let's see. He's writing to me. I'm on hold. He's on hold. He's going to call you back right now. So
okay.
The next call should be him.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Okay. Oh, this is quite interesting. I'll try again. Okie doke. Well, worst case, let's see. Oh, maybe I wonder if he's trying to call through Skype. If he's home, I could, you know, do that. Let's see. Let's delete this. And I'm not getting anything. It's not calling in. Not my day. Please, I hope everybody gets it. Okay. I'm so lucky. How the heck can he be on hold if he's, I'm not sure. Okay. Let's see what happens if I dial his home number. Are we ready? Here we go. Let's see what happens with that. Call failed or was not answered. Okay. That didn't work. I'll try again. I don't know what he, maybe he's, well, wait a minute. Let's see what happens. Okay, let's see what this is now.
Merle, this Roy, is Roy.
Do I have you?
You've got me.
Okay.
Sorry, you must have had some kind of connection problem earlier, but I've been on hold for 10 minutes, but I'm glad I'm with you now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Hello from East Lansing, Michigan. And my apologies for whatever inconvenience caused to you and your listeners during the
technological breakdown. I got to play some music in between.
Good deal. Well, I'm getting hungry after listening to the discussion about the Whitney restaurant. So I had to have
a sandwich. I know. I understand. Okay, let's first talk about. Actually, I want you to talk about the Hebron glass collection and how it was acquired.
Well, thank you for asking. I'm calling from Saper Galleries in downtown East Lansing, Michigan, and we're so fortunate to welcome you and other travel writers a couple of weeks ago during your Michigan visit. And what you saw at Saper Galleries was about 1,500 to 2,000 works of art by about 150 artists from about 15 countries. And every year I do some explorations in countries around the world, not necessarily being the sole purpose of the trips to find works of art, but I do discover them. I was in Costa Rica a couple years ago and discovered the Cocobolo wood boxes that we show on our website that have drawn a tremendous interest from parts around the world. And I also made it to the Palestinian territory, to the city of Hebron, the largest city in the West Bank, where I did come across the glass from that area. And if you'd like, I can give you a little bit of information on how that came about and what the experience was and what the glass looks like. Hebron is an ancient city. Some say it's 3,700 years old, the oldest continually occupied city of civilization in the world. In fact, I think it's mentioned in the Bible 87 times. But think about it, founded 3,700 years ago is a long time. The glass that comes from Hebron that I had read about before going there has been produced there for about 2,000 years. And when you think about that, that's a phenomenal period of time. And so I went to the Middle East in part to pick up my son, who happened to be doing some work with a non-governmental organization in Nablus, in the West Bank, the Palestinian territories. And I went there, and I picked him up, and we spent a little time in the West Bank and went back to Israel. And then I met with an artist friend of mine, Ruth Factor, who is on our website. She creates these beautiful ceramic tiles that you would have seen at the gallery when you were here a couple of weeks ago. And we got talking about Hebron because I expressed to the artist the interest that I had in Hebron glass. And it seems as though if I've traveled halfway around the world and I'm only an hour or two away, that I have to make that visit, that exploration trip to see if I can, A, get into Hebron, B, find the glass, and C, most importantly, get out of Hebron. And the artist and her husband said, well, 10 years ago, to go into Hebron, you'd have to bring your own security force. You wouldn't just go into Hebron. And now, because of the tremendous conflict in Hebron, nobody would go to Hebron now. And, in fact, in speaking to others, I found that's the case because there are conflicts in Hebron. And if one would go online and look up anything dealing with Hebron conflicts or Hebron in the news, one would see what I'm referencing. So I decided to go into Hebron because I was warned not to go into Hebron, kind of like telling your kids not to watch this TV show at that time, or their fresh cookies in the cookie jar, but we're saving them for something tomorrow, so while I'm gone tonight, don't go in the cookie jar.
Right.
So I decided that meant I had to go into Hebron. I found the one renter of automobiles in Israel who said it would be safe to use my car to go into the West Bank territories and to go down to Hebron and also into Nablus and Ramallah. And I'm thinking, why is that even an issue? But if you go into the West Bank with an Israeli license plate, there's possible conflict by somebody who might not like those who are coming in from Israel. So I went into Hebron and sought one of the glass factories. Years ago, there were literally dozens of glass factories, and now there's one producer of glass in Hebron. He has two different factories. And the reason for Hebron Glass going from many dozens of makers of the glass to only one maker in two different factories today is because of the difficulty in getting in and the difficulty of getting the glass out. Tourists do not go to Hebron. Hebron is not Paris or London or any other popular vacation spot. Hebron is home to about 250,000 Palestinians and several hundred Jewish settlers who are around the old quarter. And Hebron is most noted for it being the burial site of the biblical patriarchs and matriarchs, the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Rachel, Leah. And that's what Hebron is most noted for. And it's interesting that occupation of Hebron, it was originally British, but it was from Roman times, but more recently British. But then it's alternated between the Palestinians, the Arabs, and the Jews. And certain areas in Hebron, there are restrictions where one can go. So it's had a lot of history that's really fascinating from the early Bronze Age to the current times. So I drove into Hebron from the north. Hebron is about 30 kilometers, about 19 miles south of Jerusalem, and I'm driving down what would be a normal street anywhere else, and then came across the Hebron, one of the Hebron, two Hebron factories, and I was just, it was thrilled. It was like discovering a tomb. The fact that a guy from East Lansing, Michigan is now in Hebron, where there are no other Americans, there are no other tourists. The only people there are the people who live there, either on the Palestinian side or the Israeli Defense Force occupied side, and a family of four from the United States. And when I went into the, parked the car and went into the, I'll use the word factory because that's the word that they use, I came across a very, very old-looking stone building. And in the center of the building with an arched top was a long furnace. And connected to the furnace was a black tube that connected to a large blue barrel filled with some kind of fuel. And that fuel fired this furnace. And it's that furnace which for many, many centuries has been used to create the glass from Hebron. It's fascinating glass. It's now made of recycled glass instead of sand as it was used when they pulled the sodium carbonate from the Dead Sea traditionally over the years. The actual production process is a secret that the Palestinian families who created the glass now maintain. But the glass is, imagine this, it's kind of Phoenician-shaped. Old-style shape largely, but there are so much more contemporary designs. But there are swirls of blues and greens and russet colors that swirl around in almost a kinetic way around this beautifully shaped, variously shaped glass objects with narrow necks and wide bases or with like a hip or a bottom bulb, and they're all totally unique. when I was there, it was Ramadan, and during the day there was no glass blowing because you don't work during the day. And at night there were four glass blowers who would come in, each having their own technique and their own style, but all creating this beautiful, this magnificent, really unique glass that only is found in this place, in this part of the world. It's so rare to find. I felt like I opened a tomb and discovered this great unknown that people back in the Midwest and the United States would love to see. So I,
Roy,
with my family,
me,
went.
What yeah. I want to hear about is that particular adventure in trying to get out of there.
Oh, trying to get out. Well, we selected the glass, and I said to the glass people there, I said, let's package it up, and I will take it back with me. And they looked at me and gave that sheepish grin that said, no, you can't take it back with you. Because to get out of the West Bank, you have to go into Israel to get on an airplane to get out. There's no airport in the West Bank or the Palestinian territories. So I watched them package the box and thinking, well, how are you going to get it out? And what they did to get the glass out was they brought it up to East Jerusalem, which is part of the Palestinian territories, and got it into Jerusalem and then got it to the airport and sent out. But the real question is, Roy, how did you get out of
yes.
the West Bank? And so it's easy to get into Palestine. The reason it's hard to get out of the West Bank is the Israeli Defense Forces are very concerned with ensuring that the country of Israel, the state of Israel, is protected from any threats, and they're very concerned about anyone going into Israel from the Palestinian territory. There's a large wall, or some might call it a fence, but a very, very large barrier that you can't, it's so high you can't throw a ball over it, that goes around the West Bank to protect Israel, some would say, from what some might call the terrorists or those who might come into Israel. So anyone who leaves the West Bank, as I was going to do, has to go through a checkpoint. And checkpoints are not like TSA stations at our airports. They mean real business. Their guns aren't holstered pistols. They're automatic weapons that are held up. And they're sniffing dogs, and they mean business. But the people who mean business, they are college-age students, members of the Israeli Defense Force. And just prior to this expedition to Hebron, when I picked up my son in Nablus, we tried to get back into Israel from the West Bank. And we parked the car. They asked us to open the four doors, open the trunk, and open the hood. They told us to get out of the car. And then one of the officers took the end of his automatic weapon, and he pointed it at a piece of paper in the trunk of the car. And he asked, what is that? And I lifted the paper up, and it had Arabic writing on it. And that Arabic writing included a photograph of a building in Nablus. Nablus, where the Intifada started, where suicide bombers are trained. It was not a good picture. And so the several IDF forces gathered around the car, wondering what to do, in that somebody was attempting, myself and my family, were attempting to go into Israel, yet we had on our possession a paper, a document, photograph with Arabic writing on it. And as I lifted that paper and they were considering my observations that I was pointing out that my son was there for a project, non-governmental organization, teaching young children, particularly refugee children and others, art and music and other elements of enjoyment that we take for granted here in our country, but refugee children in the West Bank are not privileged enough to have the benefit of. And as the paper was lifted up, there was a bag underneath it that was given to my son in the West Bank as a departing gift on his way home. And the writing on the front of the bag said, I heart Palestine. I heart Palestine is not the type of writing that Israelis usually favor for somebody going into Israel. So they had us take all of our bags out, put them on a long table in a bunker-type building, going through the X-ray machines, as one would at an airport, and the Israeli Defense Forces unzipped our suitcases, and in one of the suitcases, he lifted up the bag and looked at us and said, and he's holding it with his pointer finger and his thumb kind of away, as a little bit away from his face, from some distance, in fact, and he said, "Whose is this?" And I was quiet, my wife was quiet, and my son said, "It's mine." He was given, as a departing gift when he left his assignment in Nablus, a copy of the Quran.
Oh.
The Quran is a book that's not favored or looked upon favorably by Israeli defense forces. And my son remarked that this was given to him as a gift, parting gift by an artist in Nablus who said that it's an interesting book and that he might benefit by looking at it, reading it, learning what it says, rather than just hearing from others that the Quran must be bad. So my son accepted it as a gift, put it in the bag, and we drove on our way. And the Israeli Defense Forces did not seem that sounds reasonable, because they asked how long we've been in the Middle East, and we said one day. We just got here and came right to Palestine, which was a second point of concern. Nobody goes to Israel and then right away goes right into the Palestinian territory, unless you have some business in the Palestinian territory, in which case there might be something wrong with you relative to the interest of the country or the state of Israel. So they quickly separated my son. They put my wife and I in what I refer to as a prisoner jail, but it was a metal building adjacent to where my son was kept, detained and questioned. And over a three-hour period, my son was questioned by automatic weapon-pointed inquirers. And after he would respond, they would come to my wife and I and ask us the same questions to see if our responses were the same as my son's. They ask what religion he is. And then when he said Jewish, more faces came out of the picture where he was in total amazement that there's something going on here that's not right. Others were called in, and then they came in and asked us what religion he was. And I said, "Ask him his Torah portion." And then while my wife and I were in what I referred to as our little prisoner jail, Palestinians, Arabs, were brought in and sent in either with us or right outside our door. And the Palestinians were looking at the Israeli Defense Forces, who are up their weapons extended, and saying, "What are you doing? These are Americans. Let them go. These are Americans. They're funding your operation here." Incredulous that they would be holding Americans, questioning Americans who are just minding their own business. And then the Israeli Defense Forces, they would put on their gloves as though it was a surgical operation, and they put my son behind a draped curtain, and they needed to investigate what else he might be having on his body that they don't want brought into Israel. That gives you a sense of how things are at a checkpoint. If they don't want you to come in, they won't let you come in. And of course, I'm thinking, we're going to be separated. How are we ever going to meet up with our son, and where will they take us, in that they have our passports as well? And as an aside, I remember in an earlier trip going into Palestine from Israel, on the northern part of the country, that as I entered Israel, there was the world's longest row of cars waiting to get out. People were outside their car just waiting. It's almost like there was a drawbridge up, but it was never going to come back down. And as we were entering, going south into the West Bank from the north, the people were shouting out of their cars at us, "Where are you going? What are you doing? You're going the wrong way. Turn around." In other words, they were trying to get out of Palestine while we were the only car actually going into Palestine. It took about 3 hours, and they told us that they will be letting us go eventually. But we were sitting there. Imagine sitting there with many gun-toting, very excited-looking defense forces trying to figure out what they can do to detain you longer and possibly prohibit you from going into Israel, where we eventually would need to catch a plane to get back home.
So, Mike, the question then is, was it all worth it for the Hebron glass?
Well, I have a true confession for you, Merle. And nobody in the world knows this except you and me. So this is just between you and me. Are you ready?
Yeah.
This morning I was thinking that of the 51 pieces of Hebron glass that I had shipped back from Israel, most of them having made it, some of them did not make it because they were broken, which is probably because there was a little sticker on one of the boxes that had something about Hebron, and it's possible that that box might have had a little extra movement during the shipping process before it got to the airport when it was left in Jerusalem. But as I was looking at our collection that we have here at the gallery, we started with 51 of these beautifully formed, exquisite, and colorful vases. We might have half dozen now. Nobody knows except you and me is that I'm trying to figure out a time when I can go back and select more. So my clear intent is to go back more. And as I tell you that, I have this image that I have to share with you, that when I parked my car in Hebron, I parked it in a large, flattened area of rubble, which used to be stone buildings, and mine was the only car. Imagine a field as large as a football field, but it's all rubble, and you're the only car in it. You just park in the middle, and then as we started to walk out of the car to go down Shehuda Street, the street that the Israeli Defense Forces have really taken control over and closed all the buildings, all the businesses there, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years ago, a couple Arabs started running at us. And as the Palestinians came to us with a frightened look on their face, they were saying, please, is there anything you can do to help us? Is there anything you can do to help us? They saw us as some kind of potential savior for them, that we would be able to provide them some assistance, whereas about two blocks further away, it was all Israeli Defense Forces in clumps of groups. And again, with their automatic weapons pointed forward, not just simply slung over their shoulders. So it gives you a sense of how tense it is. But it's not the first time that I've been in such an environment. And the market in Hebron, the open market,
Roy, what I want to kind of get to, because I have a guest calling in now, It basically with your with the galleries. I mean, these are all things that you acquired, that you bought, and now displaying in your galleries to sell. Am I correct?
Yes. And we buy them from the artists.
And they're not necessarily well-known artists. There's like what your eye enjoys or what you think
is. Most people would recognize the names of at least a dozen of our artists. People have heard of Picasso. People know Rembrandt. People know Moreau. People know Chagall. People know Dali. So those artists are in our inventory. We own them. There are works of art for sale. But we also carry works of art that people have never heard of before, artists whose names maybe not be familiar. We have about 1,000 artists every single year, a couple dozen a week, who approach us, send us their portfolios, bring us their portfolios, and otherwise ask us to carry their artwork. 1,000 a year, we accept maybe 3 or 4 of those artists in a year. So there's greater than a 99.5% chance that we'll say no to an artist rather than bring him into our fold. But if we do bring in a new artist, they're great, and they're very deserving of having space in our gallery. So it might be an artist who you never have heard of before, or an artist whose works you visit when you go to a museum.
Okay. What is the website?
We welcome people to visit us at sapergalleries.com. Saper is S-A-P, like Peter, E-R. Galleries is plural. And at sapergalleries.com, we have a live chat function so people can just type and connect with us right away, so we're typing back and forth as they visit pages on the website. And we'd welcome listeners to Whirl with Merle to visit us 24 hours a day, anytime, any day at sapergalleries.com.
Okay. That's so great. And thank you for sharing the story with us. And
my pleasure. It was a treat to welcome you to the gallery.
Yes. And definitely like make and by the way, you were on the chickens blog as well, just in case you...
Oh, I understand. There were a couple chickens that you brought with us, and I enjoyed the photograph on your blog. of the fish of the chickens taking in the art displays.
Okay, I'm glad.
A pleasure visiting with you. Thanks so much, Merle.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
Thanks, we'll visit again. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, we're continuing with some more art. Do I have the, is it Matawi Tile Works on?
Noelle Matawi is here.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Of course, it was my chickens who screwed up the
the tile. Did they mess up your tile?
Well, tell us a little bit about the place, and then we'll go into, like, what's involved in making a tile.
Oh, sure. I'd love to. Well, Matawi Tile Works is a 21-year-old art tile making company that I founded back in a garage. And these days, I have about 30 people on staff, busy either making tile or trying to sell it or taking care of all of the above, of course. And we make tile that for projects that would go in your home, like a kitchen backsplash or a fireplace are our specialties. And we also make just beautiful art pieces, tiles that are sold individually as original works of art.
Okay. And
does that encapsulate it pretty well, Merle, do you think?
A little bit. When we get into this whole aspect of how it's all made, I think people get a much better idea. Because the first thing, part of our tour, we went into a room that had, I guess it was like the tile in stages, so to speak, right?
Right. You were looking at the design phase.
I'm sorry,
and
it was
then
the chickens that were looking at the...
Of course. Yeah. Esther and...
Esther and Eunice. Well, actually, Marilyn and Minerva were there, but that's okay.
Oh, okay.
They look like Esther and Eunice. It's hard to tell them apart. Yeah, go ahead.
I know I had trouble.
Yeah. Sometimes I do, too. But so, okay, so what are... Tell me, so are the tiles made of clay? That was something I was just
of
trying
course.
To... What is
very... Basic, yes. So the tile are ceramic. They're made of clay that we actually mix from powders that come out of the ground. I mean, that's what clay is, of course. It's not that we dig it directly out of a riverbank, as some people think, but it's they're mined materials that are powdered, and then we mix those powders together into a special recipe that becomes Motawi's tile clay.
Ah. Recipe meaning do not taste it.
Right. Do not try this at home. It's,
yes.
It's not something,
don't have
you know,
it for lunch.
Sometimes,
yeah.
You know, the dog sometimes would pick up little bites of clay and chew on them, but we don't recommend it.
Okay. The chickens wouldn't bother their stomachs, so I don't care.
No, I think they would benefit from a little tidbit of clay here and there.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get... So now you have... we have the clay, and the clay is, I guess, now made into squares. Is that like the next thing that happens?
So we take our clay... Yeah, we kind of put it through an old-fashioned Play-Doh maker, a spaghetti maker, sometimes people think. We kind of squish it, and we squish it out into a square tube, and we'll cut lengths of clay... Let's say we're making a 4-inch tile. Yeah, we'll make a little chunk of clay, essentially. We'll extrude a chunk of clay, and we'll set it on a press. And we use a hydraulic press. This is the one part of our operation that's not completely hand-done. The press comes together. It's basically, there are two molds that come together, and the clay is essentially squished into the shape of a tile. And then we'll remove that tile from the press, and there's always an excess that comes along with that. We'll trim that excess off the edge of the tile. And then people don't always know this, but in ceramics, you typically fire the object two times. So after the tile air dries for about a day, we'll put that tile in a kiln and fire it to 1940 Fahrenheit, pretty hot. And then it'll come out and it'll be like a piece of pumice. It'll be like a rock, but not very hard and
mm-hmm.
very porous. And then we'll apply the glaze, which is essentially glass. Glaze is essentially the powders that make up glass mixed with water. It's a solution. Right. And so we'll pool different colors onto a tile of that glaze, put it in the kiln, and fire it again for another almost 24 hours, but a little bit higher this time to about 2100 degrees. And then the glaze will melt and it'll fuse to that clay body. And the clay body itself will shrink and vitrify a little bit more. And then it will become quite hard. And then you have it, and a day later it cools and you have a tile.
So now at this point you have the tile, and now you're going to create whatever it is that you're going to put on the tile. Am I guessing?
Well, no, the tile, so what's on the tile is already baked in. So
okay,
if there's
so
a design on the
point,
tile, it's actually in the mold.
Okay.
Yeah. So we might have a relief tile, in which case that mold has that mini sculpture backwards. In the mold, so when you press it out, you actually have, it's like a tiny bas-relief sculpture. And then, so the design is already in the tile when it's made in the very beginning stages.
So at what point, like when I was, I'm sorry, when the chickens were given, when the chickens
right.
were given a tile to do their artistic work in, at what stage was this?
So they were given a piece of freshly pressed tile. So the clay was in its moist stage, and after the chickens had their way with it, it would air dry.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they put the design in right then, and then after it's been fired once, we're going to glaze it for the girls, for Eunice and Esther. And,
okay.
And Minerva and... So we'll glaze it and fire it again.
Yeah,
so you
okay.
should be receiving it pretty soon.
Oh, good.
In the mail, yeah.
Okay, so now, I am, because I was trying to catch this. You can either sit there and just carve your whatever you want, but there's
right.
also you can draw something on paper and...
You know, we do a kind of a make-a-tile event here at the Tile Works a couple times a year where anyone can come and do what you guys did. We'll give
mm-hmm.
them a freshly pressed tile. This is on our tile extravaganza days. It's a big kind of a sale and crazy day we have twice a year. But so people come and get a tile. They might even bring their tools. Some of them bring a drawing on paper, and they... literally, sometimes they just use the paper as a template, kind of like carbon paper, and they'll press right through the paper and leave a line on the clay and then carve out their design that way. Sometimes people just kind of copy their design over.
Uh-huh.
So they'll carve out the clay, or maybe they'll pile up extra clay on top and do something that's really dimensional. We had one person at one of our more recent sales did this amazing, it was kind of a shark attack tile. It looked like the shark was coming straight out at you.
Really?
Yeah, it was amazing. Just a person at one of our sales. We kind of wanted to keep it, but we had to, you know, give it back to them. And actually, I think that one is on our Facebook site. Might be one of the coolest ever customer make-a-tile tiles ever made.
That's really great. Now
it was really fun.
But in terms of, okay, so is there, like, so people understand, is there somebody
uh-huh.
that's sitting there doing one tile at a time?
So what happens, you know, it depends on which part of the process. So, of course, we have a press that runs, and I have a couple of guys that work running the press and trimming the tile and getting it all formed in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two or three guys working in that department, just literally making the physical tile itself. Then after the first firing, some of the tiles need to be hand glazed. Well, they all need to be hand glazed, but some of them get multiple colors. And so I have a room full of workers, I think about 8 of them right now, full time, who literally, it kind of looks like they're doing paint by number or cloisonné when they're working, because the tile has a tiny little relief, like a little edge, like a paint by number line that's three-dimensional. And my glazers sort of paint with different colors within those lines, and they make the designs show up by using different colors of glazes in different areas. So we make all kinds of beautiful designs, lots of butterflies and some geometric things, many of my own creations.
Who actually makes the designs?
So I am the artistic director, and I've historically drawn most of the pieces, and I work with a lot of guest artists as well, who make beautiful drawings that I actually adapt to our tile work. So we work with some folks that aren't with us anymore, like Frank Lloyd Wright.
Okay.
I work with the foundation, and we think of it as a collaboration across time, where I will take some of Mr. Wright's designs and render them in a way that looks great on a tile, and the foundation over there will approve the designs or not. Typically, within the staff, we're drawing designs, and we'll put them in front of the rest of the staff and see what they think of them. What I've learned is that if I let the staff kind of vote on some of the designs before we put them out, put them in the marketplace, I learned that if I like a tile and no one else does, it'll never sell, except to me.
Okay.
So we do a design charrette, and even if I'm doing all the drawing on a piece, I'll put it in front of my employees once in a while, and they will be able to point out areas where I can improve that I couldn't even tell just because I was so close to the artwork.
Right.
They can be amazingly helpful. So in a sense, I don't draw every single tile anymore. Indeed, with Charlie Harper, some of my staff we're doing some Charlie Harper designs on tile. And in those cases, I'm really looking over an interpretation and saying, let's try this instead of that, or move this line over here. And so, as far as I'm concerned, Matawi tile doesn't have to be designed by Noel Matawi. It has to pass muster by Noel Matawi.
Okay. So, in other words, it's not, once you have a design on a design, is that particular design like mass-produced on tiles, or it's as opposed to like one of a kind?
I see what you're asking. Yes, of course. As mass-produced as Matawi gets, no, we're going to make unlimited editions of a typical tile.
Okay.
We don't count them. We'll make them for as long as people are wanting them, typically.
So in other words,
limited editions. I think I have one piece that we're limiting at 250. It's quite beautiful, kind of complicated, and it's pretty precious. So we're limiting how much we're making of the, if it's a large 12-inch pine landscape, a particular piece.
Mm.
Mostly we don't, though.
So that after, like, you design them, like, the design then goes on file. Is that what it does?
You know what?
So that at some point you can recreate it again after you make the first batch, let's say.
You know what we'll do? We'll make a batch. We'll, if we're going to release a tile and kind of, what we'll do is we'll have a group of tile that we're making for a year. And we'll make them available in our store and on our website and to galleries that carry Matawi tile. Once a year, we change that selection. So we'll bring out new tiles, and we'll maybe discontinue tiles that haven't been as popular, and we'll bring in the new things and change the collection over. So we literally refresh the collection every 12 months.
Yeah, when we were all given a tile to take home with us, did each of us get a different tile, or was it one?
when your group of writers came to visit Matawi, we gave each of you a tile. I think there were three variations. So each of you might have gotten one of three different pieces.
Okay, I was just kind of curious as to, in terms of, so people understand how, if you want to call it mass-produced or non-mass-produced, that they are, kind of thing.
Yeah, I would, you know, I feel like Matawi is always sort of in a funny place in the marketplace because we defy categorization, because compared to a single artist in their studio, maybe hand-pressing the tile one at a time like we used to do, without hydraulic assist on the pressing part, you know, we're the 800-pound gorilla of the typical art fair artist in a way. But when you compare us to a real tile-making company, they, you know, Florida Tile will make as much tile in an hour as Matawi will make an entire year. So to me, that's mass-produced. So what we're doing is, you know, we're a very small maker in terms of the tile industry at large. But, you know, as I say, compared to my garage days, we make a lot of tile.
When I saw there was an area where you can buy seconds, what does that mean? And I broke. Is it obvious? Or is it...
You know what? Matawi's, every time we make a project, we have extra tile that are perfect, that are just overruns, and we also have tile that there's something a little bit wrong with. Maybe it was a little too light or too dark or has a speck on this corner or something like that. And so instead of just throwing those in the trash, we keep them and we offer them to people at a deeply discounted price.
Okay, so in other words, to someone like myself, I probably might not notice. I'm not an art collector or whatever.
Most of the seconds are pretty, you can't tell. From across the room, even Matawi people can't tell. And I have to say that some of the things that we call, you know, we're just getting very hard on ourselves these days. We used to sell things that had more flaws than our seconds do now. We've just gotten very picky, and everyone benefits.
Okay, and just to let everybody know where you're located.
We're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the address is 170 Enterprise Drive. And our place isn't easy to find. You do have to look it up on a map. You can always get directions at and learn more about the company from our website. Also has tile for sale online, and the website is motawi.com. That's M as in Mary, OTAWI.com.
The other thing I guess that you could also do is ask like somebody from Ann Arbor Tourism, huh?
Absolutely. The Convention and Visitors Bureau knows all about us.
Coincidence of who's on.
Oh, you can. Oh, is it really? You know, one thing that we love it when people do is to come to our free public tour that we have every single week. We literally do that 11 o'clock every Thursday. So people that work during the day have to play hooky. But we open the studio and we give a guided tour every week for about an hour. And you can come and see the place. You don't even have to call ahead. Just show up.
Okay. That's so cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, people that come on the tour really love it, and it always surprises me how much people enjoy getting their hands in the clay like you and the chickens.
Yeah.
There's something kind of magical about getting your hands in clay.
Yeah, I didn't kind of realize that in terms of tiles, it's not what you're carving like you're drawing, but how you're doing for the indentation part so that the drawing part is what's projecting.
Mm-hmm. It's really sculpting.
Yeah. It wasn't until afterwards that I got that, and I went, oh.
Yeah, you'll have to do it again.
I'll have to do it again.
We have people that come back time after time and just come primed with their ideas to try that tile making again.
Yeah, I think so. Ann Arbor Tourism, what do you think?
We love Matawi tile.
Hey, who's over there?
Yeah, we got Ann Arbor Tourism on the line as well.
Excellent. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Merle, it's a reunion. We were all together
yeah.
a week ago.
Well, then I'm gonna let you go, and then let the two ladies talk about what else there is to do in Ann Arbor.
Excellent, excellent. Lovely talking to you, Merle.
Oh yeah, it's great, and I had a great time.
Excellent.
And so did chickens too.
Tell them we
Have
enjoyed your
day.
Company. You too. Bye.
Bye. So, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. So, I think actually, in my blog, what happened? I started to do this whole thing. I think I'm up to the point that I'm just about in Grand Rapids and about halfway through, and my word count is like already 3,000, and I'm going,
oh my goodness.
So I have to break this down. So what's going to happen, actually, in this Thursday's Queens Times, I have part one, which is just all about just Detroit itself. So I figured I'm going to break it down to with that, and then the second one is going to have Ann Arbor and East Lansing.
Okay.
And then the last one will have the whole thing on the art prize stuff. God, this is so much to write. Hey, you know, I have a feeling I'm the only one of the writers who's going to be also describing everything I ate, too.
Well, we're glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, I certainly did. Introduce yourselves. Go ahead.
Sure, no problem. My name is Mary Kat Eichenberger. I'm the communications manager with the Ann Arbor Convention Visitors Bureau. I actually wasn't able to be part of the press tour. I was out of town, so Danielle and Laura were there. But Danielle's with me. Laura's out of town this week.
And I'm Danielle Fergus. I am the Tourism Sales Account Executive with the Ann Arbor Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. And it was great meeting you a few weeks ago, and I loved meeting the chickens. It was so much fun.
God bless their little bodies, huh?
Oh, that's right. Did you have a good time while you were in town?
Oh, yeah. I have to tell you, to be very honest, I thought to myself, I don't know why I'm going on this press trip. I'm not much for art. But what happened is like, so I kind of looked at it and I said, I'm going to do this anyway. And what I'm just going to concentrate on is what do my eyes like, as opposed to reading about it, or who did it, or, you know, and what I got was a lot. And I got what I appreciated was what my eyes were enjoying, and that there were so many different types of fine art to deal with going from one place to another. Because it wasn't like, you know, like going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art at five different places. Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Each one that we went to was a different type.
Right.
So that's what I enjoyed. So let's go. Let's talk about what we did in Ann Arbor. What did we do in Ann Arbor?
Oh, sure. So we visited Matawi Tile, as you just heard from Nawal, and then we went to Lena's for lunch, which is a great, they serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I believe you had a sampling of different options. Hopefully you enjoyed all the different entrees that they had brought out, including the fruit water, which is always delicious.
My favorite.
Oh, that was a great idea. That was not such a nice idea.
Yes. they do such a phenomenal job at that, and they have different concoctions every day. So one day it'll be the blueberry mint like we had on the day that you were there, but other times there'll be other different unique fruit waters, which are always delicious and refreshing.
Now,
and then finally
believe,
we have dessert.
Yeah. Well, I believe, by the way, that what the chef is into is he wants everything to be fresh. That he was,
right.
That in his background, that he has that thought of going to the, you know, the local market every day and buying what you want.
Right.
Kind of thing. And that's what he kind of looks to do at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
definitely.
And,
all of his options that he has are definitely very fresh and made to order. Nothing sitting on the shelf or frozen.
Which is great. He also wants to make sure that you're that you're not cold either, huh? So he puts a like little fireplace in the front just to.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a neat modern fireplace that they have right when you walk in.
Yeah. Yeah, then we went for dessert.
Yes, at Frida's, Frida Petito's. And we had some lovely fruit smoothies, which, of course, you can get with or without rum. And then our churros dipped in chocolate.
Yes. I'm going to pig out as soon as I get off the finish this show, I think.
We're just filled up your appetite. For ours, too. Like running down the street.
So what I want to talk about is places that we didn't go to. What else is there? And what is, like, Ann Arbor? Kind of describe, let's say, what the city is like and what it's noted for.
Sure. So Ann Arbor, as many people know of Ann Arbor initially because it's the home of the University of Michigan. So Ann Arbor has a lot going on based on the students that come to town, athletic events. We have a big house, which is where the U of M football team plays. It's one of the largest football stadiums. So that's an exciting draw. In terms of art, there's a bunch of other places, too. The university has an art museum that is on campus but right near downtown, and it's a wonderful place to go check out. So that's a cool art spot as well. I don't know, I guess you guys didn't walk around downtown too much, but we have a lot of art galleries as well downtown, all over, so those are fun places to check out art. Let's see, other favorite spots that we love of Ann Arbor. We love to shop. There's a lot of great boutique shopping stores, so that's always a fun thing that Ann Arbor has. It's a lot of boutique shops. There's not a lot of shops that you see, you know, place after place, so that's really nice. A lot of handmade items at these shops. And as you pointed out, the food, Ann Arbor is a foodie town, so we've had lots of groups come and just try out different restaurants. So a lot of unique, again, restaurants just like our unique shopping. So not chain restaurants, you won't probably find many of those downtown. So we have a lot of variety of different cultures of different types of food. So if you ever come back, I can show you some more places to eat besides those two. Some of our other favorite spots. We have a lot of different outdoor recreational activities to do along the Huron River that goes through the city. And so we have these really cool cascades, these man-made cascades that you can take down with your kayak or your canoe and experience the river. So being outside, which right now it's starting to become really beautiful with the changing of the leaves. But it's a really popular spot during the summer to go and be on the water.
I think am I going to get this right? The Broward Museum, that's where was in Ann Arbor.
The Broward Museum.
Broward, Eli and Edith.
Oh,
well,
I
have it as Broad, but somebody keeps pronouncing it as Broward.
That's actually the Michigan State Museum.
Oh, okay.
Their Museum of Art there.
Yeah, so the one in Ann Arbor is sometimes referred to as UMA, which stands for University of Michigan Museum of Art. So that's the one, but you guys weren't in Ann Arbor long enough to go to that one. But did you guys go to the art museum in Lansing?
Well, I have here that I wrote that I went there, and I thought it was, no, you're right. Wait a minute. That's right. East Lansing. Right. Okay. So actually in Ann Arbor, we didn't do a lot. We basically that we went to the Matawi Tile and ate. And that
yes.
we did. Okay.
Yes.
Just,
it was a short visit, and hopefully you enjoyed your time here. And
oh,
that way
yeah,
you can come back again and again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, sometime we'll have to, you know, get a little more in this. I'm interested now that I did the fine arts. I would love to do the same type of tour with the performing arts.
Oh, yes.
With
that
all
would be,
of
yeah, we have two
yep.
Theater, well, we have a theater out in Chelsea, the Purple Rose Theater, that was started by Jeff Daniels. That is a popular spot. And then we also have Performance Network Theater downtown that puts on some great shows. And then we have a musical venue called The Arc downtown as well. So, yeah, lots of really – and also a lot of U of M, University Musical Society, UMS shows as well. So, yeah, performing arts would be a wonderful trip. Go to a bunch of shows.
Oh, good. What would you now, in terms of the people there, would you say it's a college town or mixed, or what would you kind of categorize
it? Definitely a college town. Our university is very close to the downtown, so it's very much together in comparison to some other college towns that might have them more separated. But there are a lot of Ann Arbor residents, a lot of some of the major employers in Ann Arbor, University of Michigan and the University of Michigan Hospital. So we do have quite a few local residents in addition to the students that come in every fall.
Oh, good. So,
but
and
that,
if
yeah,
I, so in coming back there, what, like, would you recommend that you say, oh, you missed these places. These are the places you must go to because we didn't get to do it.
All right. Let's see. We'll conquer this with our favorite spots. One of my first, I think you should go to when you come, is Carytown, which is a fun shopping area right near Main Street.
Okay. Yeah.
And then right Carytown is Zingerman's, where they have the Zingerman's Deli and Coffee House there. They also have a Zingerman's Roadhouse, which is actually a sit-down restaurant a little bit further outside of the downtown area. But Zingerman's is really a phenomenal company. They do a lot of farm-to-table type of food, and it is all based off of like a Jewish deli. They do amazing Reubens and different types of sandwiches that are huge and very, very delicious. And then, of course, they make their own cheese and ice cream and bread, all sorts of other things as well. We actually, quite a few local restaurants use Zingerman's products, and a lot of local grocery stores sell them as well. So they're like a nationally known brand that started in Ann Arbor and has remained a part of the downtown culture.
And in terms of cuisines, can you, like, find a number of cuisines of with the food in Ann Arbor?
Do we find a variety of different kinds? Yep. Yeah, there. So that's just one kind that people are like know of or come to Ann Arbor and say, I've got to go to Zingerman's when I'm here. But absolutely, there's all different kinds of culinary, like, for different people. Right along our main street, I think, you know, I can just name up, we have like a seafood restaurant, an Indian restaurant, quite a few breweries downtown. We have an Irish pub. So just a huge variety in addition to the Talina and Frida's that you went to.
Okay. It looks like a lot of tourism places are now advertising what they now call gayborhoods. Is there one in Ann Arbor?
You know, I haven't heard of an area that has been called that, but I have heard of those in other cities. I haven't heard of, like, a specific section of the town. Most neighborhoods don't have their own distinct, at least in the, unless they're known as right near downtown or kind of on east or west side of Ann Arbor.
Okay. Of course, that's what...
Let's keep our ears open for that. Because I know I actually have heard of that in other cities, so...
Okay. I was just curious because that's another, I guess, happening that's going on is that a lot of the cities are identifying the LGBT communities for people, you know, in terms of tourism. So now I'm just asking if there is. What is there as far, is there any, other than, like, the, are there any historical places that should be visited? Or hysterical places, either?
Hysterical or historical. I think, too, there's a lot of different buildings on U of M's campus that are pretty historical that have been around. Actually, I was thinking that there's even a bunch of art monuments on campus on the campus of U of M, and we've taken people on tours of that just to see the art that's outside. I'm trying to think of some more historical. We have a lot of places downtown that have different plaques about what the city used to look like, and so you can kind of see from that what the town was like before. I'm trying to think of like a big one spot to check out.
So was there anything like particular that people would know that happened in Ann Arbor, you know, in terms of the American history? Or not that I care, because I don't even interested in history, but I was just gonna ask anyway.
I think Ann Arbor was a pretty important spot during the rallies during the Vietnam War in the 70s, so different campus protests that happened, U of M. So I know that there's those that might be, you know, some of the places where the protests started. That could be one. I'm sure there's more. I'm sorry,
I'm just curious if, like, you know, it was a place where having to do with one of some wars that went on here. You know what I'm saying?
I think so.
No, okay, good. But then it's a non-war place. Just people can place that people could enjoy and not have to, you know, visit some place where, you know, there was a fort or there was a or something that had to do with anything that had to do with the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or anything like that. Just go and enjoy yourself.
That's right. Just come and have a good time, experience our shops and our restaurants and the nature.
Yeah.
Just come and have a good time with us.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing this information. I guess you got a website?
Yes, we do. If you go to www.visitannarbor.org, you can explore all the different things to do. And then we're also all over social media as Visiting Ann Arbor on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for sharing this.
Thanks for having us on. Thank you.
And now I have to go and eat. So
there we go.
After all the talk about the food.
Make a trip back soon.
Okay. I hope so too. Have a great evening.
You too, Merle.
Thank you.
And I'll say hello to the chickens for you.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, bye, guys.
Bye.
So hopefully I'll go back to Ann Arbor. Maybe I'll bring the other chickens this time. I don't know. But anyway, so I got to find the thing. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to end the show a little early. And I think I have, I'm probably going to do a show on, I believe, today's Wednesday, on Friday, to talk about a place called Local, well, that has, and it, we're going to be talking about various milk dairy products in terms of, like, you know, skim milk, whole milk, 2%. You know, all of that, and how does it differ, and how does it make a difference, and are they, even a bigger question, are they all the same? And all I just wanted to share with you right now is I tasted the non-fat milk, and I had this expectation of skim milk, which I hate because I might as well just drink a glass of water. And I went, okay. And, you know, I could certainly get away with having the non-fat milk and not say, yuck. So I haven't gotten to everything else, but everything else must be delicious. So we'll have them on, the company on I won't even tell you the name right now because I'll put it up there. So in the meantime, everybody, have a great day, evening. And be kind to me. No, be kind to me and everybody else. Please don't shoot anybody. Take care. Okay. Bye. Where is it? Wait. Music.